New Hampshire Public Radio News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. If New Hampshire is really worried about its status as the nation's fourth oldest state, our guest today says there is a solution. Stop towns from snob zoning, the deliberate exclusion of moderate and lower income housing. We're talking this hour with journalist Lisa Privo. She's author of the new book, Snob Zones, Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate. Privo says New England towns have been especially guilty of going out of their way to keep out certain types of housing, and by extension, certain types of people, through zoning regulations that make it near impossible for builders wanting to construct these projects. And in her book, she offers up one town from each of the six New England states as an example. In New Hampshire, Privo chooses the Lakes Region community of Ossipee. She describes the long battle there over a proposal to build 24 units priced at below market rates. Residents voice many fears, especially that the development would bring in too many children who would cost the school system money. The builder took the town to court and ultimately prevailed. Privo says most people don't see the development as a problem today. But she says Ossipee's struggle is emblematic of what takes place all across New England, and she warns that snob zoning is now coming back to bite the region as it loses young people and talented workers because they can't find a decent, affordable place to live. Today in The Exchange, author Lisa Privo is here, and let's hear from you. Do you see what she calls snob zoning in your community or not? Do you think her criticism is a bit unfair, that one person's snob zoning might be another's historic or environmental protection? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Lisa Privo, it's really nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
So what is snob zoning, Lisa? Recognizing this is subjective, but what is it? Let's get your definition.
Well, the title of the book is fairly provocative, Snob Zones, and people might think I'm writing all about affluent towns, keeping out less affluent people. But really what I'm referring to is zoning regulations that are very restrictive in terms of the type of housing they allow, usually restrictive against multifamily housing, and sometimes to such a degree that, you know, anything other than a house on an acre of land is not okay.
So if you can't afford to buy a big house on an acre of land, you're out.
Right. I like to think of it as kind of one-size-fits-all zoning.
Yeah. So is it sort of middle and upper income people then saying, no, we really don't want you here if you're of modest means?
Well, that's kind of what I set out to find out when I wrote this book. I, as a reporter covering real estate for a decade or so, I would see the same scenario play out over and over again where a developer or a nonprofit would come in and pitch a development of some sort, and no matter whether it was, on a lot at the edge of town or whether it was, you know, a beautifully designed project, no matter what the circumstances were, the reaction was always fairly intense against it and often hostile. And, you know, we've come up with this catch-all phrase, NIMBYism, to describe that reaction, not in my backyard. But that didn't seem to me to be truly accurate. There seemed to be so much more going on there in terms of why people oppose these developments. And I don't think it's just, a matter of, well, we don't want that kind of housing. We don't want those kind of people, although certainly there is some of that. But there's a lot to it, historical context, social context, lots to think about.
So more than NIMBYism, that's interesting. How is snob zoning more than NIMBYism, not in my backyard?
Well, the reaction is what I'm talking about when people not wanting it anywhere. There's a woman I was talking with in northern Connecticut who has worked very hard in her own community to get some affordable housing built. And she said, you know, everyone says we love affordable housing, but we don't want it there, we don't want it there, we don't want it there, we don't want it there. And there needs to be kind of an awareness, I think, that it needs to go somewhere.
Yeah. And we should say that you currently live in Connecticut, but grew up in New Hampshire. The book looks at all six New England states and the rules and regulations and so forth that create what you call snob zoning. Why do you think, Lisa, that New England is particularly guilty of this?
Well, as the oldest region in the country, we have our own traditions that we stand by, which are, you know, our own idea of what a town is supposed to look like, and which is why we have some very lovely towns still. But, you know, there are some realities to that, which is that we're aging, and we can't kind of keep everything frozen in time. There is room for a little variety in there.
You also write about this this feeling in New England towns about taking care of our own.
Mm.
So we feel very town-like, and yet we work regionally, even nationally, even internationally. Talk about that a little bit, too, if you could, Lisa.
Yeah,
that's an important concept.
Yeah, that's a very New Hampshire kind of way of thinking, I think, which is charming on the one hand, where, you know, we're going to take care of our own. But on the other hand, you know, there's the flip side of that. We're not going to take care of people who we view as outsiders. And, you know, this goes back for centuries in terms of how towns were required to take care of those who were down on their luck. And each town had a responsibility to look after their own poor people. But we have changed since then. People, you know, don't work where they live, and we need to think, I think, more broadly when we think about community.
So the fear is, in terms of affordable housing, and again, what you call snob zoning, that if we build this 50 apartment building, or if we build this 20 project with 20 small houses in it, affordable housing projects, then, quote unquote, those people will move in. They're not our own, but we'll still have to take care of them. That's the fear?
I heard that certainly in Ossipee, and I've heard that up in Maine. And, yeah, I mean, people don't think, you know, I work hard. I pay my taxes. Why should I have to pay for somebody else? But, you know, it doesn't usually shake out quite that way. And in what often happens is that it's people within the community who end up moving into the housing. It's not all, you know, people driving up from 100 miles away to take advantage of it.
Yeah, it's somebody who was living in a tent in their parents' backyard, or was mm-hmm. couch surfing and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I want to invite our listeners, Lisa, to join us, and then a lot more to talk about. Our number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're sitting down with journalist and author Lisa Privo. She specializes in housing and real estate, and she's got a new book out. It's called Snob Zones: Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate. It looks at the policies that she says have led to a lack of affordable housing in many New England towns, and the harm she says that causes not only to those seeking a decent place to live, but also to these states overall as our populations age, as workers go elsewhere to seek better housing. Give us a call. Tell us what you think about this. Our number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Do you see what Privo calls snob zoning in your own community? Do you think that there are shades of differences when it comes to snob zoning, that one person's snob zoning might be another person's attempt at environmental protection or historic preservation? And what do you think a reasonable balance is between the need for affordable housing and the need for open space here in New Hampshire? The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And let's talk, Lisa, about environmental protection. You say that snob zoning is often disguised as environmental protection. Give us some examples.
Well, the best example in my book is the town of Roxbury, Connecticut, which is in Litchfield County. It's become half second home community, half full-time residence. But it's had 3-acre zoning for almost its entire landscape for quite a long time. A few years ago, the Zoning Commission announced that they were going to change it to 4-acre zoning, and there was kind of a backlash there against that by some local people who felt that it was unnecessary. But what's happened there is they've preserved 20% of the land for as preservation land, which is terrific. But at the same time, that makes the community much more desirable for people who are very affluent and want that kind of surrounding and want that privacy. And it is kind of this cycle that's made the community more and more expensive, to the point now where it's one of the oldest communities in the state in terms of median age of residents, and their numbers of young people are plummeting. So, you know, because they're trying to save the land without making any kind of acknowledgement that you also need a place for regular folks to live, it's kind of out of balance there.
So your beef with them, if I could put it that way, isn't that they're trying to preserve open space, this forest or this field.
Absolutely,
or this riverfront. It's more that don't require every house to be on a 4-acre lot.
It's more a balancing of the human ecosystem. You need to have some place for all different classes to live, I think, because you need all types of workers. I mean, for a town like Roxbury that relies on volunteers for its firefighting force and for its EMTs to run the town, they're all volunteers except for a few paid workers. If you don't have those people, how do you keep a town going?
Right, and 65-year-olds, bless them, maybe they shouldn't be EMTs.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so what's the balance, though? I mean, you know, people in New Hampshire, as you well know, are worried, especially, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago before the recession, they worried that paradise is being paved over, basically.
Well, I think the two can coexist. I think you can save land without, you know, saying that there's all, no room for some multifamily housing. There is room for both. And the idea that putting houses on large lots is somehow good for the environment, I think, is kind of crazy. It pushes development out farther and farther. If you want to save the land, save the land. I don't see that as saving the land. I see it as a very inefficient use of land.
So putting, again, houses on big lots, usually cutting down forest at the skirts of town to put houses on big lots, you're saying that's not preserving the land. It's better to make smaller.
Sure.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break. And start taking your calls. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And we'll be back in a minute.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. What's going on this week at NHPR? Well, there's an easy way to find out. When you sign up for our new e-newsletter this week at NHPR, you'll find out what the exchange, word of mouth, and our newsroom are planning for the week and get a behind-the-scenes look at the station. Click on the Connect menu to sign up for our e-newsletter at nhpr.org. More on snob zones, fear, prejudice, and real estate coming up on The Exchange, and then a 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, The Grassroots Fight Over Fracking. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, helping you create eco-friendly sleep environments, also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. And from Franklin Pierce University, a leader of adult education, offering an RN to BS in nursing, new term begins soon. Information at franklinpierce.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the history and impact of exclusionary zoning with Lisa Privo, journalist and author of the new book, Snob Zones, Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Do you see examples of snob zoning in your community? Or not? How do you balance the need for affordable housing and the desire for green open space? The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Lisa, let's go right to the phones. And Sharon's waiting in Manchester. Hi, Sharon. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I've been a city planner for some 30 years in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And a big part of my career has been dealing with affordable housing on both sides of the issue. But a lot of the problem with large lot zoning has to do with the fact that we don't have public water supply or public sewers in New Hampshire. people need to have a septic system and a well on their lot. You can't do that on small lot zoning. When you depend on volunteers on your boards, it's very difficult to review sophisticated water system and sewer treatment plants. And I think that the solution to say it's merely a housing problem, we have to look at the infrastructure as well.
Wow.
I
think there, yeah. Go ahead, Sharon.
I think there's groups in New Hampshire. New Hampshire Housing Finance has wonderful outreach efforts working with communities around community character and understanding infrastructure as well as what the market is. And there are folks in the state who are trying very hard to be inclusionary and to make it a place where we all can live.
So, Sharon, what do you think? Is New Hampshire guilty of snob zoning or not? And is it more like a town-by-town thing? Or what do you think, Sharon, given your experience in this?
I've seen it really around the infrastructure issue, that it's difficult to do denser development without public water and public sewer. That gets the discussion about whether or not it's exclusionary gets lost in the, can we safely provide clean water and dispose of wastewater in a cost-effective way that's going to keep the housing affordable.
Okay.
So it's a much more complicated issue than just communities trying to keep out poor people or different people.
Sharon, thanks a lot for calling. Important point, Lisa, and one that I hadn't even thought of. The infrastructure. She's right. I think about 60% of New Hampshire residents are on public water supplies, but a good 40% are not.
Sure. And I mean, of course, that's an issue in terms of the numbers of projects that have been proposed. I mean, it's not that it's impossible to build these projects without public water and septic. But what I was interested in is when a project does have everything going for it, why is it still opposed? And the example from New Hampshire that I use in the book is Ossipee, which did have the necessary water and sewer connections in the village where this particular 24-unit development was proposed. And it seemed to be an ideal site. It seemed to not be anything that was going to be damaging to the community in any way. And yet there was still this opposition. So I'm not condemning every community as being, somehow hostile to affordable housing. What I'm saying is when these projects do work, why are they still opposed?
Do you think that the environmental concerns are real, Lisa? Again, we talked just before the break about in the 80s and 90s, New Hampshire grew very quickly, and there were all these studies put out that, again, quoting that song, you know, we were paving paradise and putting up a parking lot. I mean, are those real concerns or are those excuses?
No, sure. I mean, everyone is concerned about development and the pace of development and what that means for taxes. But at the same time, you know, there are consequences to not allowing for a range of housing. And we're certainly seeing that in New Hampshire and in other places in New England. I mean, we're aging quickly. We're losing the younger segment of the population that will be crucial to the workforce in the future. It's just a reality that, I think has to be balanced against environmental concerns. And like I said, I don't think that one precludes the other.
Yeah, you talked about the housing lot size and so forth earlier. You talked about the aging of New Hampshire and New England. It's not just New Hampshire and the idea that that's tied to a lack of affordable housing. But some people have questioned that analysis, Lisa. They said this trend is just as much about declining fertility rates, a slide in migration from other states due to the recession. There are plenty of people in New Hampshire who've studied this for a long time who say it's not necessarily the aging and the housing. They're not making as tight a link as you are. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think there, it's complete cause and effect, but I certainly think that people do move out of New England to find cheaper places to live.
All right. Let's take some more calls if we could. The phone number here on The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Lisa, let's go next to Nashua. Chris is waiting there. Hi, Chris. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hey, I love this type of program. I hope you do a lot more of it. Couple of quick thoughts. First thing is, if you want to take a look at a really good way to manage just the land, I know there was a comment about if you want to manage the land, manage the land. Go out to the Front Range in Colorado, where they have this incredible land banking program. I mean, it preserves these wide-open vistas, so it's just amazing what you can do when you really, you know, have a full commitment to do that sort of thing. The second thing I want to say is, like, in regards to the infrastructure, you know, when you lay out highways, you get cars, you get, you know, all these, you know, issues of suburban sprawl. When you put in mass transit, you get clustered housing. And clustered housing is really what is most favorable to senior citizens and, I think, you know, families with small children who want to be able to access a wide variety of cultural amenities.
We did a show recently, Chris, I don't know if you heard it, on the fate of downtown here in New Hampshire and how there is this movement back toward downtown. But, Chris,
yep,
for
I
you,
yes.
You did. Okay, good. So this is right up your alley. What yep. about those folks, though, who may have a couple kids, who want the open space, who move to New Hampshire because they want to, you know, hear the crickets chirping at night?
Well, I think that's a valid concern. I certainly live out here in suburbia. I mean, I think there's a time and place for everybody and everything. That's one of the great things about the U.S. is that we have this diversity of choice. The problem is that, you know, with the aging demographics, with a variety of things, I think that the suburban model is extremely expensive and essentially unsustainable.
Okay.
You know, for communities that care about things like budgets. I mean, all of these things, this wide open infrastructure is extremely expensive to maintain. So,
Chris, thank you very much for calling in. What do you think, Lisa?
I think he's absolutely right in specifically in terms of the need to build closer to mass transit and to build in areas that are already built up. You know, the way that the demographics are going in this country, we have the baby boomers entering retirement and a good portion of them will want to downsize out of their family home. And we have the millennials coming up, the people in their 20s and 30s who a number of surveys have shown are not so much interested in the big suburban tract. They like walkable communities. They don't drive as much as previous generations. And that type of housing will attract them. And it's not available in a lot of communities.
So maybe market forces will take care of it, Lisa. What do you think? I have heard about the trends you talk about, too. Again, in our downtown show, we covered it. The millennials want walkability. Urban cores are growing. The numbers show that. Older Americans want to downsize, want walkable. So maybe this is going to happen organically. We don't need to force it.
It's possible that it will happen. I mean, certainly there are towns already doing it. In Connecticut, where I live, there's an incentive program the state has to try to get towns to at least look at how to plan for higher density housing in their downtowns, because it makes economic sense it attracts business to the downtown. It attracts young people who add vitality to towns. But you have to allow for it.
Well, and so the question is, in 5 years, in 10 years, given these demographic forces, these market forces, will there still be snob zones? I mean, we still have to worry about this, or is the market pretty much going to solve this for us?
I doubt the market will solve the problem. We've had snob zoning for decades, and I think it'll be around.
Let's take another call if we could. And John's joining us from Northwood. Hi, John. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Yeah, I happen to own a lot on a private road that's about 500 feet from the main road. And how my town affects me is that I'm trying to sell the lot, and they say, well, you have to pave the entire road in order to have the next lot. You know, and that's just, that won't happen. And there are private roads all over the community. It doesn't matter how good the private road is. If it's not a paved road, then you lose all your rights.
So relate this to our conversation about affordable housing, John. I'm just wondering how this connects to what Lisa's talking about, the snob zones and so forth.
Well, there is no affordable housing, because if you make someone build a $60,000 paved road to get to your one lot on a dirt road, which is rural in nature, you're forcing someone to build a development when maybe they don't want to, and the cost to pave a road where there's a existing dirt road that's satisfactory makes it more expensive.
Sure.
So it can't be affordable if you tell someone you have to pave the road.
Would you like to build affordable housing on your lot, John?
I would.
Okay.
I would.
All right. I think I see where you're coming from on this then. Is this an example of snob zoning? Maybe not a zoning rule, but a requirement where he'd like to do that, but he can't afford to pave the road out to this potential project. What do you think, Lisa?
I'm hesitant to comment since I don't know all the circumstances, but certainly there are requirements in some towns that are pretty stringent in terms of what they require for size of a lot, frontage on a road, those kinds of things that may be a little more subtle than simply large lot zoning. But there are ways to make development so expensive that it deters developers.
Which is how John feels. And again, we don't know the specifics of his case, but I'm glad you called, John, because it's an interesting example. Maybe the town has a point. Maybe if you create a development that has 10 apartments, for example, there's an argument that, you know, there's enough traffic that generates that you need to pave the road. I mean, is it fair to automatically ascribe the title snob zoning to everything?
No. No. And it very well may be a matter of safety needing to get having a paved road to get emergency vehicles in and out.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, to hear from John in Northwood, a rural community. There are some communities here in New Hampshire, I'm sure you know this, Lisa, towns like Concord, Manchester, Hooksett, they feel like they're sort of the victims of the snob zoning by other communities. They feel like, look, we have too much affordable housing and the other communities aren't picking up their slack. I wonder what you think about that argument.
Well, in Connecticut, where I live, that is certainly the feeling in a lot of areas. Connecticut is a little different in that it has a law that says every town is supposed to have worked toward 10% affordable housing, 10% of their housing stock. If you do not have 10%, then a developer who comes in and proposes affordable housing is given more leeway and can oftentimes override local zoning to get the project in if it isn't damaging to the public health and welfare. But even though this law has been in place for a couple of decades, you still have towns surrounding urban areas where the poor people are concentrated in urban areas, and then there's great affluence all around them. And these towns might have 1%, 2% affordable housing. Part of it is it's very expensive to develop there, but part of it is they put in very restrictive zoning decades ago and have done very well at defending it.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because in the book you talk about various court cases, various laws that have happened, as you say, over the decades, and yet not that much has changed. How come?
Well, that's a very complicated question.
I'm sure. That's why you wrote a whole book about it. But it's interesting because you talk about this one court case in Chester, New Hampshire, for example. And, you know, after this court case, all the affordable housing activists said, hooray, things will change now. And then you write, nothing changed. So I'm just wondering what's going on there. You mentioned the example in Connecticut as well.
Well, you know, it all depends on, I mean, the Chester case, they basically said, look, every town these towns aren't islands. You're part of the state. You have to, when you're zoning, you have to consider the community at large. But, you know, if that's just a court decision, there was no law that went along with it in terms of, you know, telling towns specifically what they had to do. And so, you know, there wasn't a great incentive for anyone to change their zoning after Britton v. Chester. And
although then the threat of being sued was maybe greater than before.
Yeah, there was. But from what I've been told, you know, developers don't really like to be in the business of litigation. So.
Sure, it gets nasty and it's
bad
PR and it's expensive. Now, as I understand, and I went over these materials over the weekend, New Hampshire did pass a law in the late 2000s, 08, 09, requiring some level of affordable housing. But that hasn't made a difference either from what you've gleaned.
Well, you know, yeah, essentially, after years and years of debate in 2008, yes, New Hampshire adopted its workforce housing law. And it's certainly very different from the one I mentioned earlier in Connecticut, in that your town is just supposed to create the opportunity to allow for it in a realistic and meaningful way. But, you know, 2008 was in the thick of the housing crash and the recession. And so I think it's kind of hard to say how that's going to play out.
Let's take another call. And Avery is calling from Union. Hi, Avery. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Yes, Laura. I have a question regarding the practice of towns in both Maine and New Hampshire only allowing exclusionary 55-plus zoning for housing developments.
Sure.
And the impact that has on a community. I sat on the planning board in Lebanon, Maine, and sat in the next town in Acton, Maine, and they had a lot of discussion about, oh, we're going to allow X number of permits, but only for 55-plus housing.
So your question, Avery, or your comment is you see this as exclusionary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and this is a trend you write about, Lisa, in the book. Thanks for calling, Avery. What do you think, Lisa?
Yes, this was a trend, the height of the building boom throughout New England. It was a way for developers to get approvals more easily for projects because if there were no school children, then towns had fewer objections. I know in Connecticut they were overbuilt, and a lot of those developers have gone back to the town and said, "Look, we're not finding any buyers for these."
Even in aging New England, there's not enough 55-plus people to fill these things?
Because the demand was from people trying to start out, and it's actually, you know, kind of ideal housing for people trying to start out. They're smaller and walkable, and I think, like anything, it's an idea that works in moderation, but not as a way of keeping out families, you know.
We talked a lot about this on The Exchange a couple years back when this trend started, maybe 5, 6, 7 years back. So you're saying, Lisa, this happened not just in New Hampshire. This was everywhere. New England saw this 55-plus housing project boom?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So what Avery's talking about is right up your alley.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting that it is legal to build a development that doesn't allow children, which kind of goes against logic, but it is what it is.
All right. Well, Avery, thanks a lot for that call. Our phone number for you to join us on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, and we'll be right back in just a minute.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Groponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Groponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at groponi.com. And New Hampshire Catholic Charities, creating hope and leading people to a more secure life. Details on Catholic Charities' annual appeal can be found at nh-cc.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
We want you to be our newest Leadership Circle member. I'm Betsy Gardella, president of NHPR. The Leadership Circle helps fund the programs that capture the spirit of New Hampshire. As we approach the end of our fiscal year, Tillman Gerngross, Sylvia Richards, and Barbara and Dick Couch are challenging you to join the Leadership Circle. When you contribute $1,000 to NHPR by June 30th, they'll add $500 to your gift. Join our Leadership Circle at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the debate over the Fourth Amendment freedoms from unreasonable search and seizure. Email us your thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, author Lisa Privo is here. Her new book is called Snob Zones, Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate. It looks at what she calls snob zoning in all 6 New England states, including New Hampshire. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Lisa, right back to our callers, and Mike's calling from Amherst. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Good. Go ahead.
I have a question relative to affordable housing to whom. You know, there's a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt about drawing demographics to a community that are perceived to be less desirable. And I fully appreciate diversity in population and diversity in housing type. But I think there needs to be some clarity in the conversation about who the target is for, quote, affordable housing. New Hampshire statute under 674 defines workforce housing as people who are earning the median income. And the statute even extends further by saying that communities have an obligation to accommodate housing, workforce housing, in a manner that is economically viable. And that's unique in state statutes across the country.
Mike,
and
do this is a great point, affordable versus workforce versus another term that comes up, public housing. Do you think then, Mike, that New Hampshire law and New Hampshire communities in general are doing a decent job providing affordable housing?
I think New Hampshire has done a remarkable job at defining, one, the need of bringing in housing for people of a working wage, and that's generally defined as 100% of the median income defined by HUD. And it also tries to make accommodating workforce housing voluntary on communities across the state. And some communities, particularly urban areas, have more than their fair share of housing that qualifies as workforce housing. But there are communities that don't.
What about Amherst, where you're calling from, Mike? Does that have more than its fair share or not?
Well, Amherst has a very long history of affordable housing under its own ordinance before the workforce housing was initiated. They made a concerted effort to build housing that offers opportunity to a fairly wide range of economic population.
Okay, Mike, thanks a lot for calling in, and lots of points. But Lisa, maybe we could settle on this idea of affordable housing versus workforce housing. Mike didn't raise it, but I'd like to raise it versus public housing, because there are some terms thrown around in this conversation.
Yeah, it's a good point to clarify. Affordable housing is kind of the umbrella term for any kind of housing that is where the cost is below market rate. It's subsidized in some way. The term workforce housing came about because the term affordable housing had become so loaded in terms of what people thought it meant. So workforce housing is a little more specific in that it, as the caller indicated, is really targeted at people who earn a certain income level. He mentioned the New Hampshire law says it has to be for people earning no more than 100% of the median income. In Connecticut and Massachusetts, the law says around 80% of median income can go as low as 60% of median income. But the takeaway here is that it's for people who are working but don't earn enough to pay for market rate housing in a way that isn't burdensome. What workforce housing isn't is public housing, which we all associate with, you know, sort of the dark images from the 60s and 70s with the projects that were really poorly conceived that were in urban areas primarily. And that isn't what workforce housing is.
So if you say affordable housing is below market rate, subsidized in some way, is it subsidized by the federal government or the state government? Or?
Well, there are various ways you can subsidize these projects, but and a lot of the funding has disappeared, but the way that's usually used is low-income housing tax credits, and these are distributed by the federal government, but you have to compete for them, and that is a way of cutting the developers' costs so that they can make these units available At lower prices.
Sometimes nonprofits get involved in this too, right?
Sure, mostly right. Nonprofits.
Right, and as I understand, there's also a model where some developments will have maybe half at market rates or above market rates, and some will have half at below market rates, and sort of you've got one set of units kind of subsidizing the other.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah, mixed income housing has really gained popularity, and it's a great concept. And one way towns accomplish this is by putting in what's called inclusionary zoning, which simply means whenever a developer comes in and wants to build a subdivision or wants to build an apartment house, some percentage of those units have to be made available to people of lower incomes, you know, maybe 10%, maybe 12%. And in that way, towns slowly build up their stock of affordable housing, but it's kind of blended in with all the other housing.
Let's take another call, and this is Ben in Warner. Hi, Ben. Thanks for calling. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hey, Laura. This is Ben Frost from New Hampshire Housing. It's a great show, kind of like an extension of the downtown program we did a couple weeks ago.
Right.
I want to thank Lisa for sticking her neck out on this thorny issue. It is really difficult. And one thing I want to emphasize is that, you know, the work that we're doing is we don't want to prevent people from being able to live on 5 or 10 or 50 acres in the countryside if that's what they want. Rather, what we really want to do is to provide a greater range of choices that are available to people. And you know, the zoning that we've seen over the past 50, 60 years has really prevented people from being able to recreate the New England-type village.
I
read a study a couple of days ago that did a survey of millennials and Gen Xers and boomers. And what really fascinated me was that as the millennials and the Gen Xers are coming into, say, older age brackets, their choices to purchase homes are matching those of their parents, the boomers, which really surprised me. I'd expected, in particular, millennials to be more oriented toward renting and toward an urban environment. And really, they're starting to purchase homes in suburbs, which I found quite surprising. But what was different was the types of suburbs that they're choosing to purchase in. They don't want to be in the tract subdivisions that their parents bought into. Rather, they want to be in more compact, more walkable places where they can get around, where they might have access to mass transit, but not necessarily.
So they're not necessarily choosing to live in Manchester or Nashua or Concord or Keene, but they are choosing communities where they can be a little closer to the center of town, walk around. Are they choosing smaller houses? Lisa's written a lot about lot size and why that's important.
Well, yeah, when you're getting into a village setting, you're going to have smaller houses. You're going to have smaller lot sizes. And the cost of land may be a little bit higher in a village. But on an efficiency basis, it's a much better way to use the land, and that's what those people are choosing to do.
You said you're with New Hampshire Housing, Ben, and that's the New Hampshire Housing Finance Authority. Just remind folks what that is so they know where you're coming from.
Well, we are an instrumentality of state government, not a state agency. We're self-supporting. And we do provide, as Sharon, one of your callers, said earlier, a lot of educational programs to help local planning boards and planners deal with these issues.
So what do you think, Ben? Is New Hampshire guilty of snob zoning, like Lisa says?
Well, yes and no.
Wait a minute.
it's the issue of local control. And some communities, yes. Other communities, like Amherst, as Mike said, have done a great job.
All right. Ben, thanks a lot for calling in, especially given your involvement in this issue for a long time here in New Hampshire. And boy, Lisa, we could pick up on 10 different things there. But what about this idea of local control? How does that play into snob zoning here in New Hampshire and some of the other states that you studied?
It's all about the sanctity of local control. These attitudes definitely spring from that, and people's assumption that local control means not just the ability to shape your town, but the ability to keep out certain types of housing and certain types of people. Now, I'm not saying everyone thinks that way, but some people are under that impression. And the truth is that towns, when it comes to zoning, towns only have as much authority as the state says they do. They derive their right to zone from the state. And they can't, well, they do, but they're not supposed to go beyond that authority. And that has been kind of the thorny issue.
Well, state law says they have to provide opportunities for affordable housing. And as you said, local control is kind of an illusion. You know, in New Hampshire, the towns only have the power that the state has given them. So I guess my question is, why do you think snob zoning continues if the structures are in place for a mix of housing?
Well, it's not – snob zoning isn't illegal in a lot of ways, but there are certainly things that towns still do that contradict previous court decisions like Britton v. Chester, and that's what happened in the case of Ossipee, where they had a zoning reg in place that didn't allow for construction of new multifamily housing. It said that you have to build multifamily housing within an existing building, which obviously severely limited what you could do there. And when a developer came in to build a 24-unit apartment complex and saw this regulation, I mean, he thought it was a mistake. But he went before the zoning board and quickly found out it was not a mistake at all.
So you could only build affordable housing in an existing building. You couldn't build a new one.
It wasn't even affordable. It was any kind of multifamily housing.
Any kind of multifamily housing. So he challenged his court. He won.
He won.
And the project got built.
And the reason he won is because This ordinance conflicted with what the decision was in Britton v. Chester when the judge said, you know, you towns aren't little isolated enclaves. You have to take in the concerns of the broader area. And this ordinance was really aimed at preventing people of lesser means from coming into the town.
It's the idea of town versus community.
And how you define community. You know, towns tend to zone thinking within their own borders, what's best within their own borders, and that's certainly understandable. But the courts have said community is much broader than what's inside your borders.
You know, business people have long called for workforce housing, affordable housing, call it what you'd like. What role have you seen them, Lisa, playing in this, if anything, here in New England, business people?
Well, from what I understand, it's the business community that drove the workforce housing law that got in and said, look, we need this housing. We've got to build up our workforce. I'm not sure it would have even passed without that support, but it's all about the workforce for them.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been talking about the book and how it includes six New England states, examples from all over, and you've mentioned some from your home state of Connecticut. You've mentioned Ossipee here in New Hampshire and the Chester suit and so forth. Are there any states in particular that you think, Lisa, in New England that stand out as particularly snobby when it comes to their snob zoning, or are we all equally guilty?
I'm not going to touch that one, Laura. I have to live here.
That's fine. You absolutely do not have to touch that one. Here's another question that I know you've been asked a lot, but I did want to ask you. How much has the decline in housing prices, Lisa, coming out of the housing bust, coming out of the recession, affected this affordable housing situation that you're concerned about?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a lot of people think that kind of solved the problem, the housing bust. The prices declined and, you know, problem solved. But the truth is, we had a shortage of housing that for kind of starter homes and affordable homes before the housing crash. As the market comes back, that shortage is still going to be there. And already in some of the hot metro areas, Boston and around Boston and New York and around New York, you know, spreading into the Connecticut suburbs, the market has come back such that the rental rates are higher than ever. And there's so much demand for rentals because people lost homes and because people can't afford to buy. And that's become a real problem.
Should getting people into their own homes be the goal, Lisa? And here's why I ask this question. Some folks say part of the reason that the housing crash happened is that too many people were encouraged to buy when they really didn't have the means to do so. So as we look at, you know, affordable housing, are you talking about buying or are you talking about just having reasonable options, whether it's buying, whether it's renting?
Yeah, I'm talking about both. Not everyone is in a position to buy a home. Not everyone wants to wants to buy a home.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm talking about options.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the future is going to look like here in New England in terms of the laws, in terms of the market? I mean, there's kind of two things going on. There's laws and then there's the market forces that we talked about. What do you think this snob zoning is going to look like, say, 5 or 10 years, Lisa? Do you think it's going to get better, get worse, stay the same? You talked about how we don't like change here in the region.
Yeah. Well, I think there are some market incentives that are coming along that will make higher density housing look more attractive to some towns. And we talked a little bit about the demographic changes that will drive that. But I think there will always be towns that will want to continue to fight to look a certain way. And that's why the laws are in place.
The laws are in place, the affordable housing laws.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to look a certain way, again, environmental protection, also historic protection, that's an important value.
Absolutely. And as Ben alluded to, the New England village that we all love so much, in some cases we've zoned that out.
All right. Well, Lisa, it's been good to meet you. Good to have
to
you back in your home state of New Hampshire. Thanks a lot for being with us this morning. That's Lisa Privo. Again, she's a freelance journalist specializing in housing and real estate issues. She's author of the brand new book, Snob Zones, Fear, Prejudice, and Real Estate. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, constitutionally speaking about the Fourth Amendment. Our founding fathers established this right to be secure against unreasonable search and seizure, but how far should that right extend? In the age of terrorism, how broad should police surveillance powers be in the interest of public safety? And how do past debates shape our understanding of this amendment today? Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.